The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And my guest tonight is Faye Snyder, Dr. Faye Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R. And right away we got a serious problem here because Faye doesn't know what to call me. She likes to be called Dr. Faye. I don't know about being called Dr. Peter. So I'm going to leave it up to Faye whether she calls me Peter or Dr. Bragan as the show progresses. I think this is going to be an interesting show. Dr. Faye is the originator of the causal theory. And this theory, she tells me, and she writes, explains all behavior and temperament and personalities without genetics. I like the without genetics part. I'm not absolutely certain where she stands on diagnosis. But she's definitely in there pitching to help human beings without drugging them out of their minds. I've looked at a manuscript that she sent me, glanced through it, and I got to a page that I'm going to let her explain, perhaps later in the show, but she ranks well-known people and some not-so-well-known people on a spiritual scale, starting with Jesus and Buddha. And I'd be embarrassed to tell you where she ranks me, but rank me she does. And she does that without our having ever met or talked before, although we've had some enjoyable emails, and I've just heard her warm voice on the phone today for the first time. So this is kind of going to be interesting for me, and I really welcome Dr. Faye Snyder to the show. Hello, Faye.
Hello. Hi, Dr. Bragan. It's a pleasure. This is such a pleasure. This is such a joy. And by the way, when I ranked you on that scale, it was not in front of me that I didn't even know you had a radio show. I never even knew I would have a chance to talk to you. So this is just such a thrill.
Well, and tell people where you ranked me. You ranked me higher than I would have. I told my wife, what is this person doing, ranking me? And my wife said, that's where you belong, honey.
I agree with her. You are a pioneer, more than a pioneer. You are groundbreaking. You have the guts and the nerve to take on wrong thinking, which is so it's so thick. It's so strong. It's such a hard thing to break through, and you have been out there so courageously fighting for children and fighting for people who suffer, and you're telling them you're barking up the wrong tree. This is not the way to help people. This is the way to hurt people. And I just think you're a crusader, and I think crusaders are amazing people. They have a kind of courage to speak the truth and say the truth, no matter what could happen to them.
Well, that's kind and thoughtful and wonderful.
It takes a strength.
I'm not even going to tell you the people she ranked me ahead of. You'll have to read the book when it comes out. Faye, just a few more words about where you work and what you do, and then let's hear about this causal theory and just what it is that your understanding of life is all about.
Okay. I founded the Institute for Professional Parenting in 1988, and it's called TIP for short, and I just thought that it was going to be all about teaching parents how to be what children need them to be, but it's been such a misleading title that we're it's a nonprofit organization, and my board has decided to change the name of it. So it's going to be the Park Foundation, which is Parenting and Relationship Counseling Foundation, and we're just probably going to call it the Park Foundation.
That's P-A-R-C for the listening audience. And can people get you online yet, or is that, do you have a website yet?
Yes. Right now, the website is still TIP. It's tiponline.org.
Sounds good to me. So tell us about what you're putting into your new book that's coming out in September, the Manual on Parenting and the Causal Theory.
Well, I decided to call it the manual because I cannot tell you how many times as a parenting expert and teacher that I have heard, oh, my God, the gardener's here. Let me know if you want us to go out and tell him to be quiet.
I think you need to tell the gardener to be quiet.
Okay. I'm going to take care of that right now.
Okay, and I'll just chat with folks while you take care of that.
Hold on.
Just to fill you in a little bit, Dr. Fay was a part-time professor at California State University in Northridge. She's a trained child custody evaluator. She has a special interest in the origins of criminal behavior. And she's someone who, to me, in a very brief amount of time, communicates a lot of warmth and a lot of caring. I'm sure she's going to turn out to be an empathic therapist under that umbrella of empathic therapy. And you can learn about that, of course, at our organization, which is empathictherapy.org. Dr. Fay, have you returned?
Yes, I have. My husband is out trying to stop them, and I think he just succeeded. So if worse comes to worse, I'll just, you know, go into a closet or something.
It can be done.
Yes.
This is live radio. Most people listen to it on the archive, but it's still live radio.
Yes.
I think one of my most recent shows, I actually was in the worst thunderstorm I'd ever been in, and huddled in North Carolina beside my little computer trying to communicate while I broke up continually. They did a good editing job on the archive. So tell us about the causal theory.
Okay. Well, I think I have to tell you that it really started with my being a patient, and I spent, I'm sorry, I'm a little winded because I was running. I spent 16 years in therapy, getting progressively worse, until I met an amazing therapist, and I was well within 6 to 9 months, and in the process, I wanted to know what this man knew that other therapists didn't know. Why had he had all this information and treated me in this way that worked so well when all these other therapists had allowed me to flounder and get worse and worse? So after I finished with him, I went into graduate school to find out what they were teaching, because this was a very big issue for me. And in the process, I thought maybe that I would become a psychotherapist. So while I was in graduate school, I started to learn why most therapists weren't able to help me. I studied some analytic theory, which basically, you know, helped me understand why I had sat with people who would go, and it helped me understand why the behavioralist didn't really want to talk about my childhood. And so I started to think in terms of parenting theory, because all along I had the feeling that my parents didn't know what they were doing, and that I guess I always believed that genetics never crossed my mind. So I discovered John Bowlby while I was in graduate school. I discovered Alice Miller through a fellow student, but she was never discussed in any classroom. I discovered John Bradshaw while I was on watching television, and I became interested in M. Scott Peck because of his ethics. And I was a recovered borderline, so borderlines are always innocent, professionally innocent. And the whole notion of personal responsibility was something no one had ever even taught me. Every time we ever got to the notion of personal responsibility, I thought I was being blamed. So I became pregnant, and I wanted to raise a healthy child. And so I started to put together my own theory on what it would take. And I did raise an amazing child, by the way. And as I became a clinician, I came up against how convinced most people are about genetics. And I was just blown away. By the way, while I was in my unhealthy stage, I was prescribed Stelazine, Thorazine, so you know they thought I was schizophrenic at that point. And I had been prescribed lithium towards the end of it before I found a good therapist. And along the ways, I'd been given cocktails of, you know, five, six different drugs. And I actually, Dr. Bragan had been recommended for a frontal lobotomy.
Oh, dear God, yeah. Really?
This was in New York City.
What murderer recommended that?
This was in New York City. I don't remember the name, but I think I even read someplace that you wrote that there was a period like around 1988 or something like that where it came back into vogue, and I think I remember that it was right in the neighborhood where I was living in Manhattan. And sure enough, I walked right into that trap, and as soon as I figured out what they were saying to me, I walked right out. But
this was in 1988?
Let me see.
Sounds much earlier. I mean, the 70s is when guys like Lothar Kalinowski
in New York
were... No, 1976.
I just looked it up, 1976.
Yeah, see, that's more likely.
Yeah.
Being 1976. Lothar Kalinowski was a big guy in New York recommending lobotomy. Well, this show now takes on a much more added interest for me because it's so important that folks who have had all the worst labels and been recommended for all the worst treatments, and even now for lobotomy, which not a lot of people got recommended for. I think we did do 50,000 in the first wave. And yet, talking to you for 5 minutes on the show or on the phone, I mean, you're not a, quote, borderline, you're not a psychotic, you're a human being. And it's just so incredibly important to have your voice out there. I just respect so much you're talking about this on the show, and I'd like you to talk more about your experience as well as your conclusions.
Oh, I'm thrilled. I cannot believe I'm having this conversation. I have to pinch myself. So anyway, I started to formulate my own theory because I was going to raise my own child, and I was still in graduate school. And then I was doing such an amazing job along with my husband, who was right on board with me, that people started telling me how amazing he looked and what am I doing. And pretty soon I had people asking me what my theory was and how I was doing it. So I ended up formulating it. And then as I started seeing clients, because by this time I was through graduate school, I realized that genetics was a really big issue. And even though I had intuitively been, you know, like anti...
A big justifier for doing things like all those drugs and locking people up and lobotomizing them. I think that's what you're saying. It's a big justifier.
Yes, but when I first started realizing it, actually as your name became in the front of my consciousness, I hadn't even put together that what you were standing for was you were taking a stand against the abuse of pharmaceuticals or abusing patients with pharmaceuticals while at the same time you were addressing the genetics issue. And while I had shied away from pharmaceuticals and I was thinking, this man is really amazing that he's out there saying this and he's really catching my attention, but what really, really cinched it for me was when I got that you had gone to Denmark and you had taken a look at the schizophrenic studies, and I knew that before you went to Denmark, you knew in your gut what you were going to find. You knew it couldn't be real, you knew it couldn't be true, and you were going there to find how they pulled that off.
Let me just give a little more perspective on what you're describing, because you're very close to the mark, but there's no way you would know all the details. I first learned about, and I think this is important for our audience and a part of our conversation, I knew very little about the genetics of schizophrenia and all those other claims when I got ready to write Toxic Psychiatry. And I got together at that point and had lunch with Lauren Mosier, who is now gone. Lauren was at the time the head of the schizophrenia branch at NIMH. And he had funded through his branch the Danish studies and the Finnish studies, a variety of studies which claimed to show that these disorders were genetic. And I'm sitting at lunch with him, and I asked him about that. And he said, well, just go. He could be very abrupt. And he said, just go read the studies. He said, they show it's not genetic. They show it's environmental. Read the studies. So I went, and I got the Danish studies and other related studies, and I read them. And the claims at the end would always be hinting or suggesting that the data had shown there was a genetic tendency. But the actual data always showed that no genetic tendency even could be demonstrated. I then went to Scandinavia. I was invited to give some talks in Denmark and Sweden, and I met a couple of the key figures in this. And I remember one of them coming up to me with, quote, the latest genetic study, assuming I hadn't read it. This is back, oh, God, I don't know, in the 80s. And I had read it, and I explained to him how that study actually, like all the others, showed it was environmental, and I gave him the facts. And this researcher just got enraged at me. I haven't thought about this, Dr. Fay, in decades. We're walking along the street in Denmark, and this lovely country with very lovely, kind people, and this man looks like he wants to murder me because I'd read that study too and knew it was hokum. But that's that basic history, just for your information.
Wow.
And then, of course, Ginger and I took on the violence initiative in the 1990s and wrote the War Against Children of Color, which dealt a lot with genetics. But go ahead. So you were really focused on the importance of the genetic issues, and you read my stuff, and you were glad to hear I was dealing with it too.
Yes, and so I guess what I'm saying is, along the way, my clients were saying, well, what's your evidence? What's your research? What's your evidence? What's your research? And it wasn't always the genetics issue. Sometimes I would be advising people, please don't put your children in, you know, don't put your baby in daycare. Please don't put your baby in daycare. It will be bad for your child if you do that. She'll never be what she was born to be. And so they would say, well, what's your research? You know, so I then went through a period of my life where I just started gathering my backers, and I became aware of who my heroes really were, and you became like right up front, up top. But I also had other heroes along the way, and I kind of like to say who some of them are.
Sure.
John Bowlby, Alice Miller. And John Bowlby, because of the stand he took about attachment, and he also implied that he thought that there was even more to the formation of personality than attachment, but he was going to just do that. And then Alice Miller, for what she wrote about how important expression versus repression is in the human child as well as adult. And then John Bradshaw, because he had the courage to say it's in the family. And he kind of popularized and taught regular people important concepts. And then
and moral responsibility, which you talked about.
Yes, and also
is very key.
M. Scott Peck also talked about ethics. I thought that was really important. I've come to believe that you can't have mental health without ethics.
Wonderful.
And Zen is another part of my theory. You know, it's the application of kind of karmic discipline. Let me see.
We're not going to let that one fly by. You got to talk about karmic discipline.
Okay, I will. Let me just say also Bessel van der Kolk and Colin Ross and Dan Siegel. Both of those are pioneers in proving the impact of trauma on behavior. And then Dan Siegel has shown that the way we are treated becomes the way we treat people with mirror neurons. He discovered mirror neurons. And John Bradshaw also introduced relationship skills techniques, which are terribly missing in this field. A very odd one for me was, what's his first name, Theodore Reich? He did introduce a kind of technique for going into trauma and healing trauma, but he didn't know that that's what he was introducing. But it's something that I use now, and it's really powerful.
Dr. Fay, I don't want my listeners' heads spinning who haven't had the same background as you and I. I'm actually familiar with all but one of the folks that you mentioned, and I've read them fairly extensively, but most folks don't know about these people. I'd like you to, I think it's good that you brought all that in, because most modern therapists haven't read all those people, and they're so important for groundwork, including I think, Reich.
Cool.
It's Wilhelm Reich.
Yes, Wilhelm Reich. That's right. Thank you.
I wanted to write a play about him. I got so caught up with what he was doing. He ended up a madman at the end. But
he did, and he was in denial about his own sexual abuse. And he misinterpreted the breath work that he had learned to do. He didn't understand what he was.
I don't want to get too much into all this, because these names are but names to most of the folks. And I want to hear you talk more about what you got out of this. I mean, your story is so interesting. Let's recap it. You were diagnosed with all the worst diagnoses. Probably the worst diagnosis you can give a human being is not schizophrenia. It's personality disorder, because that means you have a chronic character problem that you'll never get over and nobody's going to like you. That's what it means, right?
Right.
And schizophrenia, I mean, that's more grand, and you might even have something of a recovery and you're worthy of a lot of attention. So you really got the worst labels. You were on drugs from what ages?
Well, I think I was 18 when they started to medicate me.
And that went on for how long? Because I know you're a mature person, not as mature as me.
I rebelled around 1979, 1980.
Okay.
And by that time I had been, I'd had a 3-year migraine. And so there was, you know, I was taking a lot of Cafergot and codeine as well to complicate things.
So we're talking about more than a decade?
Yes.
On the meds?
Yes.
And you escaped shock treatment, fortunately?
Yes.
Oh,
nobody,
that's a blessing.
Nobody offered that.
And you rejected lobotomy.
Right.
And then you found a good therapist, and you started really, really looking at things. And I think that's the making of the best therapist. I think to be a really good therapist, it's really important to feel that you're not essentially different from other human beings. You're not superior to them. I like to think that I have within me what's within anyone else, and I'm sure you must feel the same way, having gone through what you've been through.
Yes, I believe that we're inherently godlike. I think we were born with a kind of divinity inside us, and then I think all the messages that we get can screw that up.
Mm-hmm. So, and where does the karmic fit in? I did let you get away with not talking about it. Where does the karmic factor fit in?
Well, that would be for adults and children, but for example, I saw a child being disciplined for sticking his hand in an elevator door. As a matter of fact, his father grabbed him and drug him into the men's room, and then I heard the lash of the belt, and I heard the screaming, and all that father had to do was let the son experience the elevator door close on his hand, and that would have been scary enough. I think the more we terrify our children out of discovery and curiosity, the more shut down they are, the less intelligent they are. And yet when we allow them to have the natural consequences for their actions, then they learn really, really well, and their curiosity stays blooming. I do think that there are times when we need to put our face in their face and show a sound in our voice of disappointment, like if a child hurts another child or calls another child names, I would put my face in that child's face and I would say, "You will not be a bad boy," or, "Over my dead body will I let you hurt someone." You know, and just a really brief, fast shocker, because children want to please. So that's a kind of karma as well.
I don't understand the word karma there, because I think of karma as you sort of get your just desserts from a previous lifetime.
No,
sir. Being simple-minded.
No. There is the religious, you know, connotation that previous lifetimes. But I'm a Zen Buddhist, and I see karma in terms of right now, cause and effect. Right now, I believe nature is working with us like angels. You know, the natural results of our actions is constantly teaching us how well we're doing and what we need to correct.
I gotcha. We're going to be taking a break in about 2 or 3 minutes. Keeping that in mind, tell me some more about this theory, about how you apply it as a therapist. You're a therapist. So talk a bit about how you apply some of these ideas in therapy, and be aware that we're going to take a break in a few minutes.
Okay, well, the first thing is, I have a 3-prong approach. The first thing is that everybody has to take my parenting class before they work with me, unless they're in crisis. So the parenting class is a theory, and I don't care if they're 70 years old, they still need to go back and understand how we become the way we become. And this is a parenting class that outlines the whole thing. It deals with attachment issues, it deals with repression, it deals with matters of empathy, abandonment, abuse, and what the body does with abuse, and verbal, you know, shaming, and spiritual abuse. And so it covers all the things that can go wrong, and then it covers how healing works. And before I even start therapy with people, I want them to know the 4 traits that they have to have and exercise to heal. Everybody has them, but not everybody wants to exercise them all. And so I let them know what their part is going to be. And when they come to therapy with me, they have already diagnosed themselves in terms of what kind of behaviors they're kind of automatically implementing in their lives, and what those natural consequences are. And I do work a lot with the whole notion of personality disorder or personality structure, because it does give us a gestalt of behaviors that have to be undone in order for the healing to take place. It creates a kind of self-awareness. Given that, we believe that everything can be healed. Nothing is a label of any worth at all unless it leads to healing. And then the last piece is, that's stage one. That's the first piece.
Let me interrupt you at stage one. I think we're going to be hearing the music pretty soon for the break.
Okay.
And when we come back, see if you can give us a flavor of what a session with you would be like. Do you think you can do that?
Yes. That'll be two and three. That'll be part two and three.
All right, we're listening to Dr. Faye Snyder.
Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Why should you be listening to the Progressive Radio Network? Here are a few hosts that call PRN home. Award-winning investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker Michael Rupert. Acclaimed theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. Notable media critic and international journalist, the news dissector, Danny Schechter. Leading progressive journalists such as Stephen Ledman, John Rappaport, and Glenn Ford have also found a home with us. We also have advice from Richard Martin on how to protect yourself from the ongoing financial collapse. John Mueller tells us his firsthand account on moving out of the U.S. and making a new life for himself in another country on his show, The Expat Files. Along with all these informative programs, we also have health shows hosted by America's top doctors like Mayor Eisenstein, Cheryl Selman, and, of course, Gary Null. The Progressive Radio Network is the place for news and information.
Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art as life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination with co-host Julia Cumming. Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Premiering in 1 week.
John Rappaport. Every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, I'll be revealing secrets, deceptions, and hoaxes of the medical cartel. I've been covering this waterfront for 30 years as a reporter, and I know where the bodies are buried. With guests and commentary, I'll rip open the lid on vaccines, psychiatric drugs, the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, germ research, and media cover-ups. Don't check your brain at the door. Tune it up. Every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern on PRN, The John Rappaport Show.
To City's Grace Notes, where we'll be bringing you inspired voices from around the world, creative voices from various fields and backgrounds, new sounds, new music, and new ideas with your host, CD, every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and my guest is Dr. Faye Snyder. Dr. Faye, she has been through the psychiatric mill, and she's come out the other end on her feet. She got herself educated. She's become a psychotherapist. She's living a good life. If you get nothing else from this show, know that no matter how much you're sunk in this awful system, you too can go free and become, like Dr. Faye, a lively, responsible, fully alive, living, contributing human being. We're talking with Dr. Faye about her methods of therapy. Everyone who comes on this show, I think, by my screening or their screening, is basically an empathic therapist, that rubric that I use for our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. And it'd be interesting, maybe we can get a chance to talk about empathy along the way. But every therapist has their own approach, and I think this is very important to accept and to acknowledge, which is that therapy grows out of who we are as people. It goes out of our life experiences, our attitudes, our character, our personality. And there's a huge variety in what you will experience from a therapist. And one of the things I like to get my guests to do, but which is very difficult, is to communicate, and it would be difficult for me too, is to communicate what is it like if I, Peter Bregan, or one of my listeners, walked into Dr. Faye's office after we've been through the initial, group training. What's it like, Doc?
Okay. So the first thing I do is I would ask you to assess yourself and tell me what you think you need to work on now that you've taken the theory class, and why. What happened in your life to create those patterns of behavior and responses or beliefs about yourself?
And all right, then, I'm going to play a patient. I've never done that on the air. I must trust you.
Okay.
Doc, I'm here because I realize that I need to relax more. I've just been going full steam, and last year, you know, I'm 75 years old. I can't believe I worked as hard last year as I did when I was 35. I had a good year, a tough year, an exciting year, but I need to learn to relax, Doc. Can you help me with that?
Well,
not to put you on the spot.
Okay. I'm not sure that I see that as a problem. Until you can tell me how that's a problem for you, I love that you are so alive and so busy. Tell me how.
I think I get overtired sometimes.
Well,
and I think that my wife and I sometimes we love each other so much, but we're so busy we don't take all the time we could to savor it. Although God knows we're probably doing more than most. Stuff like that. I'm working on an adjustment. I've given it a name, Doc. I'm working on radical relaxation because it's going to be really radical for me to do a lot more smelling of the roses.
Well, I don't think I've ever had a patient this easy. I'm missing it, but I guess I would want to know, if this is truly a problem, can you tell me where in your childhood you took the class? Now, where in your childhood did this come from? Were you a child laborer, or were you expected to be a perfectionist? Why do you think you have? I could tell you.
I just don't know if I want to tell you on the air. I'll tell you a story. Yes, when I was 12, Doc. My parents sent me off to a Boy Scout camp, and they did that because they wanted to get rid of me. I didn't belong at a Boy Scout camp. In those days, it was really a place not for a young Jewish boy who was doing well in school, but for a troubled kid from the city. And it's when there was no money in the family, and there was enough money to send you somewhere else in the family. And I actually met this young man at the camp whom I really, really, really liked. But the camp was so bad, I asked my parents to take me out, and they wouldn't. And then finally they brought me home 1 week early before the end of camp. And I was really sad to say goodbye to my friend. His name was Tilly, and I really, really liked him. We'd been wrestling and playing together. I was 12. He was 12. And when I got home, my mother's reading the newspaper, and she says, oh, my God, somebody died at the camp. They've closed the camp, but you don't know him. I said, well, who died? And it turned out that my friend, just a few days earlier, two, 3 days earlier, had gotten gotten sick and died of polio at the camp. And I was terrified. I was in grief. My parents couldn't deal with it. Boy, am I being revealing here, Doc. And my mother called the local physician, and he said, there's nothing I can do about this. I don't even need to see him. If Peter gets a sore throat, a cold, a runny nose, you just bring him in. And that was the last we ever said of it in the family.
Wow.
And I thought I was going to die. I mean, polio and then was like the plague. And for those of us who were Jewish, it was like the pogrom and the plague put together. And I remember, and I think this is good to talk for me to talk about right now, I remember praying to God. My parents were not religious, but I had somehow gotten contact with the idea of God. And I remember telling God that I would be the best little boy in the world, the best little boy, the hardest working best little boy in the world, if he just let me live to be 16. Just
wow.
16. It was a modest request, but a big one by my standards. And I think that's maybe what set in place some of my best and worst traits.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I agree with you. I can imagine that turned into fuel for all the things that you ended up choosing to do that were so constructive. And I think out of trauma and tragedy, some of the greatest gifts to the planet have taken place, and that sounds like a tragic, sad, compelling story.
Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I just lost you for a minute. You said it sounds like a tragic, sad,
and compelling story. It's, again, I don't think life promises us rose gardens, to just borrow from another book title, but I think that a real fulfilling life is going to have stories like that, stories that build character or take us down. And if your story didn't have the follow-up of character building in it, then I would be more predisposed to talk to you about, you know, how other ways you could have looked at it and other ways you could have taken your choices.
Yeah,
but
choices are just so important. For and one reason I like the story, and now that I've told it, is that it really reminds us that children make decisions.
Yes.
They make decisions. I'll tell you one more thing about this, which is so interesting, which I never realized until telling you this story. That year, that next year in school, I suddenly had all these gifts that I didn't know about. That year, I think it was sixth grade, I was elected class president for the first time. I became one of the best athletes in the area of the county, let alone the school. And I started doing better in school. And I've actually never quite put that obvious series of events together. And I think I view it now in my older years as it was partly a gift in response to my request. And partly it can be explained other ways. But I'm going to let you talk now.
Okay. Thank you so much. That was just an honor to hear. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and answer your question more fully. So a person is going to come in after they've taken the theory class, and I'm going to ask them to tell me what we're going to work on and why. And then from there, we're probably going to end up doing what I call couch work, where they lie down and they breathe really deeply for a long time. And when we do that, what happens is we're able to go back in time to those moments that we stored up, that we repressed, that we hid, that involved major life decisions or philosophies of life that we took on. And so we go back in time and we revisit critical moments that left us impaired. And a lot of times they're trauma, and a lot of times they're just, taking on wrong beliefs. But what I learned is that just fixing trauma doesn't necessarily change bad habits. So I came to realize that my clients couldn't just come and visit me within the frame, so to speak, where I never saw them interact with anybody else, that they could heal their traumas and still have bad ethics or bad coping mechanisms or bad interaction skills. So I developed a group process where people would learn healthy relationship skills. And out of that, my clients started asking each other, well, what's your diagnosis? And from there, it became more and more clear as they would interview each other how their personalities were formed. Like, all the passive aggressives tended to have similar childhoods. All the narcissists tended to have similar childhoods. All the, dependent personalities tended to have similar childhoods. And they became very, very perceptive about seeing what choices that each of them had made in childhood that they had to reverse. And I came to find that we could reverse personality disorders by this process, where I actually learned that narcissists have a certain type of ethic, they have certain types of interaction skills that a dependent personality does not have. And so on the way to everyone in that room having healthy interaction skills, they all became good at perceiving each other, assessing people outside in the rest of the world, and it just became a really important part of the work, was learning how to become healthy, to understand other people, to see cause and effect in other people, to get off of the whole thing of judging people, and to see that any kind of personality cluster was temporary if it wanted to be.
And this work is in group, you're saying?
Yeah, so we do the trauma work or the regression work in private, mm-hmm. and then they go into a group where they learn healthy interaction skills. And after they become healthy, I usually ask them to stay and be sort of a leader for a year, or 6 months or something, to pay a little dues and practice, giving back, and then they move on.
Now, are you active clinically right now so people could come see you?
Oh, yes. I've been active.
Where are you located?
In Granada Hills, which is in Los Angeles County. It's on the 405 freeway.
Granada Hills in Los Angeles, Dr. Faye Snyder, Snyder. And how do folks get in touch with you?
They could call my office, which is 661-257-1020. I also have a website. It's faysnyder.com. And I also have another website, which is thecausaltheory.com.
That's a great website, thecausaltheory.com. Dr. Faye, usually when people talk with about using diagnoses, I really, bridle with suspicion and irritability. But you sound like you're using them to empower people rather than to trap them. And that's really, really different.
It is different.
Say something about that, because, I mean, usually I'd be railing against it. I don't rail, but, I would be bringing up, you know, with suspicion this use of the terms, but I get the feeling you're really trying to help people understand their sort of persistent failing lifestyles and how to overcome them, and that's where the labeling is useful. Does that sound right?
Yes, because I resisted labels for a while too because I had been so mislabeled, but I came to realize that different people do have true clusters in there, and a lot of it has to do with the parenting styles of our culture. You know, we do have people who do create borderlines by the way they are attentive and then not available and available and not available and then abusive and then domineering, and they do treat their children in ways that the children grow up to have certain types of personalities.
Do you think that you actually did fit into this cluster of having a borderline disorder?
I think I was a borderline for a while. It wasn't that hard to break out of it once I understood what my problem was, because
Do you understand by that problem and what you had to break out of?
Well, I would say the worst part of my personality was I was a professional victim. I always blamed rather than be blamed. I did not see cause and effect in my life. I saw everything as lucky people and unlucky people and exploiters and abusers, and I had no idea that there was anything I could do to change it.
That is such a poignant description of what probably underlies a huge, huge part of human suffering. You're describing how self-defeating people can become in the process of blaming others rather than taking responsibility, and that's such a basic part of human failure. And it's to your credit that you could ever see that in yourself, because the very problem keeps a person from seeing it in themselves. It's quite remarkable you did that, Dr. Fay.
Well, Dr. Bregan, that's exactly what I wanted, a therapist who would tell me what was wrong with me and tell me what I had to fix in order to fix it. And I had too many therapists waiting for me to figure it out. But I know as a child, children aren't waiting. We don't expect our children to figure everything out, or the good parents don't. You know, we help them. We tell them how it works. And when my therapist told me I was a professional victim, I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. It just went down the wrong way, and I told him nobody is ever going to say that to me ever again. And it wasn't like I figured it out.
Did you threaten to quit therapy at that point? That would be a natural reaction.
No, I was kind of devastated, but at the same time, I was extremely grateful, because out of that mirror, I got to see how I seemed. And that was, I guess if people came to see me for therapy after they do, you know, the couch work and they do the relationship skills, I guess what I have to tell you is I give people honest mirrors and I tell them how to fix it. I tell them what replaces being a professional victim, or what replaces thinking that you're the most important person in the room, or what replaces the secret deal that you've made with the world that if I take care of you, you'll take care of me.
Now, a lot of therapists would think that all of this is too controlling, too guiding, that you need to let people explore themselves and find their way more. And clearly you're saying no, a therapist should know something and communicate it.
I have to tell you, those 16 years of my life that I lost because nobody would teach me I turned it into something good, just as you turned your trauma into something good. But I don't think people should have to figure it out. Children don't have to figure it out. I look at therapy as reparenting in a way, giving my patients or my clients something that they didn't get when they were a child that they should have got.
This is very, very, very interesting and very, very important, because Dr. Fay is describing an approach which threatens a lot of other concepts of a more exploratory, supportive, and help the person learn about themselves kind of therapy. And I know that for myself, I share a lot of your views, Dr. Fay. I really believe that that as therapists, we develop wisdom, we develop knowledge, we should be well informed about the nature of human growth and development and the kinds of things that happen to children, and that we should, in fact, be teaching in one way or another. And there's so many ways. You have like three or four major different ways of teaching. I pretty much stick to individual and family and couples therapy, which is one or two or three ways, but not as many ways as you. But I believe that certainly as a therapist, I prefer to communicate directly, and I want to be communicated with directly when I was in therapy as a young man. And I very much appreciate what you're saying. I do think there's plenty of room for honest and honorable disagreement, however. And maybe future guests will present and some of my earlier guests have presented a much more Rogerian, to simplify it, approach of the therapist really being a catalyst for what the other person thinks and feels. But I really think it's important for us as therapists to bring in our wisdom. We're going to be ending in about 2 minutes. Give us a quick sum. Try to keep it to a minute or so, a summary of what you want to tell everybody, Dr. Fay Snyder.
Well, I believe we are all born miracle children. We are born to be amazing human beings. And I think when you parent a child correctly, you will raise an amazing human being. And can you imagine what kind of planet we could have if everybody were parented so that we would flourish and rain gifts down on each other? But in the meantime, if we think that we're not inherently amazing, then maybe I would like for you to buy my book, which will be available around in September, and take a look at how you can undo and redo. Because
that book is, as I finish up with Dr. Fay Snyder, that book is The Manual on Parenting and the Causal Theory. Dr. Fay, I want to thank you for your honesty above all things, and also for the hard work you've done to develop yourself into a therapist and the hard work you do with your clients. I'm very appreciative of the interview, and you actually inspired me to be more disclosing of myself than I may have been before on the show.
And Dr. Bragan, can I just thank you for who you are and what you have done, and it's such an honor for me to have had this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And don't forget, if you get the Manual on Parenting and the Causal Theory, you'll find out where I'm placed on the hierarchy of spirituality in the world. Thank you for listening to me, Dr. Bragan, and to Dr. Fay Snyder.
IPM, East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's Bregin.com.